accept my repentance and hide my offense. Through your kindness and mercy, O most merciful of the merciful.
Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were saying, where we were talking about how some of these words of Imam Khomeini are really secrets in enhancing our ubudiyyah. We talked about how we have been requested by Imam Khomeini to hasten to know ourselves, and when we have a deep knowledge of ourselves, we will find that we have been created in a divine disposition. Also, we had just talked about how we should save ourselves from self-conceit, from selfishness. These are two things which make us believe and pushes us towards this idea that we are the center of the earth, when in fact we are not the center of the earth. Continuing, we find that Imam Khomeini says, "Get on board Noah's Ark," the famous Ark of Salvation, I'm sure all of you know about. He says, Imam Khomeini says, "Get on board Noah's Ark, which is the light of Allah's guardianship, Wilayatullah. Because whoever gets on board this guardianship, Allah will be safe. And whoever stays behind and does not get on board this guardianship of Allah will become perished." It's very interesting, dear friends, but just as Prophet Nuh, in English he's known as Noah, he had this ark, right? He made this ark in which the people who got on it were saved, and the people who did not get on Prophet Nuh's ark, they perished in the great flood. Now here, Imam Khomeini says that the light of Allah's guardianship, the light, the nur, nur is the Arabic word for light, the light of wilayatullah, the guardianship of Allah, is Noah's Ark. And so in our ubudiyyah, in our servitude of Allah, we must know that Allah is our guardian, Allah is our wali. He is, again, our guardian. He is our protector. He is the one who saves us from calamities. Allah is the one who prevents calamities from happening to us. Allah is the one who gives us sustenance. He gives us rizq. It is Allah, truly, who is our guardian. And so when we realize these things and we realize the wilaya of Allah, then we begin to increase and enhance our servitude of Allah. Very beautiful statements, very profound from Imam Khomeini regarding ubudiyyah. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
My first couple of years in the Hauza, and you know, I will. They have two sets of teachers in the Hauza. One set of teacher is that teacher that teaches you the book, right? Is the Kitabi Ustad, and the other one is your spiritual guide, a Murabbi almost, right? A person who is trying to like give tarbiyah to your soul. Okay, I remember I had met the spiritual guide in my second or third year in the Hauza. I was introduced by another individual, and I had a one-on-one meeting with him. And he asked me, you know, what do you see yourself in terms of your struggles? And these are what my struggles, not that I was, I wasn't openly confessing sin. I was talking about my akhlaqi behavioral struggles. This is what I fight with on a daily basis. And he told me to make two lists. And I want all of you right now to mentally, or maybe physically, make two lists. List one, list number one, list number two. It is an unbelievable exercise. On the first list, I want you to write all those names of people that you have wronged. Whether it's verbally lashing out, whether it's an email you sent that was nasty, whether it's an argument you had in front of somebody else, a post you made about them, I don't know, a comment you made in high school that you thought was funny but really hurt them, make that list. The second list are people who have wronged you, okay? Who have wronged you. Inappropriate comments, something that was made public, you know, those kind of things. All those things are there. You know, make sure that you make those two lists. And then he says to me that as you go through each list one by one, right, on the list of those people who have wronged you, he says, fix it. Fix it one by one. If you feel this deep down sort of like disappointment and pain because of them, even though it was years and years ago, then approach them. If you can, if they're around, if it's possible, approach them and talk to them and say, look, you know what? You know that thing that happened between us years ago? I want my closure, as they say. Now, you'll sit there and tell me, well, say that was what, 15 years ago. You know, we've moved on, time has healed. If you think time has healed, that's fine. But it is important that we do a little bit of muhasabah, a little bit of self-knowledge and self-thought and self-accountability to truly understand what are those things in the pit of our stomach that causes a little bit of this movement inside of us where our stomach goes crazy now, our BP goes up, and we begin to sweat, right? If it's a sibling, if it's a parent, if it's a first cousin, if it's a spouse, if it's an in-law, if it's a friend of yours, address it. Address it whenever you can. Okay, when I say address it, I mean bring it up. Like now you're older, they're older, hopefully maturity has kicked in. You can have this conversation with them. I remember when I did this exercise, I'm still doing the exercise. It's been over 10 years. I'm still going through my list one by one by one. Can you imagine? I remember I approached one person, and this is a true story. But, you know, when I was a little bit younger, I thought I was this funny guy in school, right? The class clown, comments here and there, little snide remarks, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes I thought that, you know, in order for you to be funny, is you're being funny at the expense of somebody else, okay? So while I got a cheap laugh from the class, I could tell that person wasn't too happy with my comment. Or I would do that inside of my community, let's say, for example. Sometimes on an open mic. And I remember specifically when I really sat down and thought long and hard, thought to myself, okay, this one person I have to approach. And I approached this guy. He was married. He had kids in my community. He was a lot, obviously, you know, he's younger than me, but we moved on in life. And, you know, with him up and a little bit of courage, I remember one day after a program, I pulled him aside and said, look, you know, I wanted to mention, talk about what happened, you know, 15 years ago, this happened, that happened. Do you remember? He says, I remember. Of course I remember. I said, right? And I said, I just wanted to apologize for that. It was wrong with me. And you know what he said to me? He said to me that I have been waiting for you to apologize to me for a long time. And I feel so much better now, so much lighter now. He felt light. I felt light. We had a hug. We had a moment, you know, before social distancing, don't worry, all that, right? And that was one off my list. And you wouldn't believe how much of the anchors of the heart were lifted from that one exercise.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really
very fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the issues and topics related to the Islamic upbringing of our children, who are our future and the future of our communities. Now, to help us, we have with us Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah. Thank you very much for giving us your time.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's a pleasure being here with you.
Okay, thanks, Sayyid Abdullah. So we've been talking about the prerequisites, we've been talking about methods, we talked about the mistake of trying to mold our children. Let's talk about the things that we have to inculcate our children with. And by the way, we'll be going through these extensively, one by one. What are we going to start with?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. We have a saying that goes along the lines of dig a well before you get thirsty. If you walk in a desert, for example, don't go to the desert walking without water, and then once you get thirsty be like, okay, what should I do? Where to find water? That's obviously just a mistake. So I think I mentioned previously in one of the previous episodes that sometimes we keep finding or we keep facing mistakes and problems with our kids only because we haven't taken the prior steps to that problem. For example, I'll give you an example. If you have a dictator who just loves bloodshed and killing people, if that dictator himself was taught from a young age to love and respect others and became part of him, then it would not reach to that level. I mean, obviously with exceptions, but naturally speaking, it should not lead to that kind of result. So what we need to do is, from the beginning, we need to install things in our children's brains so they become, later on, they can they themselves avoid falling into mistakes and making problems, or we having to suffer the problems that they make.
What we're saying, that we're mostly talking about values, right? We're saying about, like, you have to be honest, you have to serve the people. We're not trying to inculcate them with the thought of you have to become a medic.
No. We're trying to install ideas, good ideas, and good morals and behaviors in their heads. So
otherwise,
there are things we need to inject into them because they play a vital role in their life. Inshallah, I'll mention a few of them, and we'll leave the details, inshallah, for later. And then we can discuss it as we move on.
Okay, so I guess we talk about probably like Islamic values and things that is for their lifestyle. What would be the first one?
Our first one is to teach our children democracy, right? Democracy is such an important concept in Islam. And we can see that from the Quran when he says to the angels, he says, "In janab al-ardi khalifa," I'm making a khalifa on earth. What do you guys think? So he's taking...
He's already made his decision. He's just
taking their
opinion.
He's taking an opinion. So he's trying to do what in the end of the day? If he's a dictator himself, look, no, done. I don't need to ask you anymore. But he's trying to teach me and you, right? Obviously, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala always teaching us. So like, democracy is an important concept that we need to teach our kids, that you need to respect other people's ideas and you need to respect other people's views on things. That you should not just be a one-sided person, right? And so what you need to do is teach the child through different methods. For example, by talking to them, giving them option. right? For example, what would you like to eat today? Make it, you know, like what you call mushawara. There's this sense of taking and giving that he feels, okay, so I'm a person, I have my value, he's a person, he has his value, and we're discussing. When we teach our kids that what I say goes, he becomes himself a dictator. And thus it grows, as they grow older, they become fanatics. So for example, you look at the Wahhabis. I am a Muslim, I am going to Jannah, and everyone's going to hell. This mentality started from a young age where the sense of democracy did not exist in their heads, that someone else could be right, someone else actually has the right to have a different opinion than yours.
I'm going to have to stop you right there. But we will be back to continue this discussion just after the break.
I am a Muslim, Islam my deen, Allah my Lord, His word Quran, Muhammad Prophet, peace be upon him. I am a Muslim for all of time. Someday, somehow, my journey here will end. I know not when Allah will call me home. This life I live, oh, what a blessed thing. As death comes to me, these words I will sing.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing with Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. So Sayyid Abdullah, we were talking about ideas and values, better yet, to inculcate our children with. You said the first one would be democracy. Would it be okay if I rename this to respecting each other's opinions? Because, and keep this out, because democracy has a very specific definition.
Okay, so you can say teaching them democracy and respecting others. So you understand the concept now. You can call it whatever you want to call it.
Okay, and just before the break, so you were explaining that one of those methods is to take their opinions and let them know that their opinions are valued. What is the next value that we want them to be inculcated with?
The next thing is teaching the child to respect the property of others. See, in the first one, when I said democracy, if you teach a child democracy and respecting others, he will not be a dictator when he grows old. And even when he becomes a father himself, he's not going to be a dictator because he's already been taught to respect others. When we teach our children to respect the property of others, we make sure that they don't turn to be thieves.
Ownership,
right? So you teach your child that if you need to take anything, and even this is an Islamic concept that you cannot take anything without the permission of the person unless you have what we call fahwa. For example, me and you, we're so close together. I know you don't mind if I use your PC, for example, or if I use your phone because of the closeness that we have between me and you. But if you're just a friend of mine or even my brother or even someone related to me, but I don't have that closeness to you that I can use your items. If I use them, Islamically, I'm doing something haram, right? Because I don't have this fahwa, I don't have this permission. With our kids, if we teach them that people, this is the items and property of other people that we should not touch, we should not take, we should not, you know, play with, that will teach the children not to be thieves and not to transgress or be usurpers, as we say, when it comes to ihtisab, like they take something that's not theirs and then it have even Islamic consequences. So it's a very important thing that we teach our children not to take and touch things that do not belong to them.
And can we simultaneously teach them about authority? Like parents have an expanded authority on their children, so parents can take their children's stuff without their permission in some instances. Or is that not true in Islam?
No. If you're talking about authority is one thing, and the child already knows that you're his authority, right? But even, for example, you teach him to respect your items as well. Because, you know, kids, and I think we've all been through this stage, we steal from our parents. We take money or cash, and we just go buy things, right? Only because we have not taught them that concept. So they know that we're an authority, but they still go do that wrong thing. Why? Because they don't understand, or they haven't been taught the value of what it means for a person to own something.
Yeah, that does sound a little bit hard to teach them, but we're going to go through it extensively. But in particularly, and we just have a few seconds for that, I meant that teaching them that as a parent I have the authority to make decisions for your stuff, or for stuff that you consider yourself like toys. I bought them at the end of the day.
Okay, that is correct, but obviously it has a sense of, you know, there's a bad to it. I mean, I would need to expand, but yeah. Time is on our side. So let's say 50-50.
Okay, all right. That's a place for us to take a break, but we'll be back for the next value. Don't go away.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. We are Islamic Upbringing, and we're with Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. So Sayyid Abdullah, we're going through the ideas that we have to inculcate our children with, respecting other people's ideas, or democracy as you put it, respecting the property of others, their ownership. What is the next thing that we're going to be teaching our children?
The next thing that we need to teach our kids is to learn to be good to their parents. Right, so these things that if the kids have been taught from a young age, I'm telling you, it will save me and you a lot of hassle. A lot of parents do not teach their kids to respect them. And as they grow older, they start to raise their voice at their parents. At some cases, they start to even hit their parents or curse at their parents or do not show any sign of respect to their parents when they are with them outside and so on and so forth. Which is a common issue that these days that we have, which kids being very arrogant when it comes to their parents. Like, they just have no sense of respect whatsoever. And that's the problem is, and the problem starts and originates from the fact that we never taught them to respect their parents from a young age. If I go back in the day, we've been taught to, in the morning, you say hi to your father, you kiss his hand, and so on and so forth, right? So you give him that, and this is something that they taught us to begin with. And as we grow older, we had more respect for our parents. But if our parents left us the chances of me yelling at my parents, and I see this happens all the time these days, kids yell at their parents, scream at their parents, curse their parents, is only because they never taught them the values when it comes to respecting the parents.
Yeah, that is very disappointing, unfortunately. And there's a lot of relief. Those parents are definitely thinking that they're doing the best thing for their children. But I think that a child who respects their parents feels much more secure and safe and calm than a child who doesn't respect their parents. Who do you have closer and more reliable than your parents?
Of course. Of course.
Thank you. That's all the time that we have, unfortunately. But if you missed the program, don't worry. You can always download an archive of this episode and all our previous episodes from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com. Find the Call of Islam link and you will see us right there, Islamic Upbringing. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. And also you can communicate with us directly through our social media accounts. Search at Call of Islam Radio on Instagram, Telegram, YouTube, and Twitter. Until next episode, happy parenting. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life. A complete way, it's a complete way.
In in the limelight.
While many rich nations continue to ease public health guidelines as they gradually move in the direction of normalcy, an ultra-contagious COVID-19 mutation known as the Delta variant is spreading like wildfire in certain countries, says Jake Johnson Ryder in an article published under the heading, Ultra-Contagious COVID Delta Variant Wreaking Havoc Worldwide. Stay tuned for more. In Bangladesh, troops are preparing to patrol the streets to enforce newly imposed stay-at-home orders. Australia, recently heralded as a pandemic success story, is returning to strict lockdowns. Scotland is seeing a record-breaking surge in new coronavirus infections. Indonesia is teetering on the edge of a public health catastrophe. While many rich nations continue to ease public health guidelines as they gradually move in the direction of normalcy, an ultra-contagious COVID-19 mutation known as the Delta variant is spreading like wildfire in countries that have struggled to vaccinate their populations and in communities that have refused to participate in inoculation drives, forcing governments to resort to drastic measures to contain the damage. The new curbs on travel and daily life stretch from Australia and Bangladesh to South Africa and Germany, but authorities over the weekend set new limits on travelers from virus variant zones such as Portugal and Russia, the Washington Post reported recently. South Africa extended a nightly curfew and introduced a ban on gatherings, sales, indoor dinings, and some domestic travel for 14 days to halt a worrying surge in cases driven by the Delta variant. First detected in India, the Delta variant is rapidly emerging as the dominant coronavirus strain across the globe. The mutation, which is estimated to be 60% more transmissible than the highly contagious Alpha variant, has now been detected in more than 80 countries, and it accounts for over a third of all new cases in the United States. The Delta strain is the most contagious variant we've seen so far, said Dr. Ashish Jha, the dean of Brown University School of Public Health, adding, it is wreaking havoc around the world and will cause problems here, referring to the United States. While the spread of Delta poses a particularly severe threat to Africa, South America, and other regions without adequate access to vaccines, the variant also puts at risk rich countries that continue to stand in the way of a patent waiver aimed at boosting the global vaccine supply. As the Financial Times reported recently, the rising number of cases have raised concerns that the Delta variant could halt the progress the EU has made over the past 2 months in driving down coronavirus infections and deaths. The leadership of the European Union, along with Canada and the UK, has been among the principal opponents of the proposed vaccine patent waiver, which would temporarily suspend global intellectual property rules that are barring manufacturers from producing generic vaccines. Experts estimate that around 11 billion doses are needed to vaccinate 70% of the global population. The EU's opposition to the TRIPS waiver is no longer a Europe-only topic, said John Whittle, senior policy advisor at Health Action International, adding, it has become an issue of global concern as the need for a waiver to diversify and scale up production is more pressing than ever. Just over a month after classifying Delta as a variant of concern, World Health Organization officials stressed recently that the mutation has the potential to be more deadly than other strains because it's more efficient in the way it transmits between humans. Dr. Mike Ryan, executive director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program, warned during a press conference that the variant will eventually find those vulnerable individuals who will become severely ill, have to be hospitalized, and potentially die. To stem the spread of the Delta variant, the WHO recommended even fully vaccinated people should continue to wear masks and take other coronavirus-related precautions, advice that conflicts with the U.S. Center for Disease Control's recent relaxation of mask guidelines for inoculated individuals. Vaccine alone won't stop community transmission, said Dr. Marian Galassimo, WHO's Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products. People need to continue to use masks consistently, be in ventilated spaces, hand hygiene, the physical distance, avoid crowding. This still continues to be extremely important, even if you are vaccinated and you have a community transmission ongoing. Public health experts have long feared that leaving vast swathes of the world without access to vaccines risks allowing vaccine-resistant variants to emerge, a nightmare scenario that would mean a prolonged pandemic and more avoidable deaths. As Nature's Evan Calloway reported recently, Delta is moderately resistant to vaccines, particularly in people who have received just a single dose. In the U.S., local governments are beginning to take action to prevent outbreaks amid growing concerns that Delta cases are on track to explode across the country. The Los Angeles County Department of Public Health advised that residents, including those who have been fully vaccinated, wear masks while indoor public spaces. Until we better understand how and to who the Delta variant is spreading, everyone should focus on maximum protection with minimum interruption to routine as all businesses operate without other restrictions like physical distancing and capacity limits, county officials said in a statement. Dr. Eric Figelding, a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, warned recently that the U.S. is just several weeks away from experiencing a Delta surge similar to the U.K.'s, which was accompanied by a rise in hospitalizations and deaths. According to the latest data, less than half of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated, meaning large segments of the country are potentially vulnerable to the strain. As Common Dreams reported recently, Missouri communities that have either declined to get vaccinated or struggle to gain access to shots are quickly becoming U.S. hotspots for the Delta variant. We have seen this movie before elsewhere. The Delta variant creeps from the underbelly of falling cases of other variants, overtakes all variants, and then causes a surge, said Figelding, adding, don't let this happen where you are.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salam alaikum, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batul. Welcome to the program For a Better Life. In our previous session, we posed this question as to what is a better life. Then we came to the conclusion that a better life is when a person is happy. This happiness is not the material happiness, but it is the happiness of the soul. So how can I reach this happiness? The answer is when I become a better person. Therefore, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. In the last session, we were talking about the steps to become a better person. And the first step was yaqda, which means to awaken. Sometimes a short sentence can awaken us from our deep slumber, from our ghafla, from our negligence, and then change our lives. This awakening can happen anywhere, brothers and sisters. It could be while listening to the verses of Quran, or it could be while reciting dua, or it could be while I am contemplating while I am alone, or it could be by listening to an advice from our parents or teachers, or a short sentence from our imam. Now this awakening, brothers and sisters, leads to an internal spiritual revolution. And it is like I am reborn. There were people who experienced this internal spiritual revolution in their lives. And they journeyed towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, Bishr al-Hafi. Now who was he? Bishr was a man who had a status in society. But he was living a life of amusement. His house was the center of carnal pleasures like drinking, dancing, loud music, and all kinds of haram. One day, his maid came out of his house to take out the trash. And at the same time, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhis salam was passing by through the same alley. When he passed Bishr's house, he heard the loud music. Then he saw the maid and he asked the maid, "Is the owner of this house a free man or a slave?" The maid replied, "Of course, he is a free man." Imam said, "You are right. He is a free man. If he was a slave, he would be afraid of his master." Then he left. The maid returned back to the house. Her master, who was busy drinking, he saw the maid coming in and he asked, "What kept you out so long? Why the delay?" The maid retold him what happened outside the house. Now hearing that from the maid, he said, "So you mean that man's last words were, 'You are right. Your master is a free man. If he was a slave, he would fear his master'?" Then he thought for a while and he said, "Yes, then he would have been afraid of his master. He would not have shown such boldness in committing sins." He started thinking about the line.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
is Allah satisfied.
How this short sentence of Imam Al-Kadhim pierced his heart. It created a storm within him. He threw his cup of wine on the floor and came out with bare feet, running fast to catch up with Imam. Finally, when he caught up with him, he said, "O my master, I beg God's as well as your pardon. Yes, I was and I am still a slave and a servant of Allah, but I had forgotten my servitude. I was sinning, but right now I have discovered my servitude and I want to repent for my past sins. Will Allah accept my repentance?" And he broke down. He started crying. Imam replied, "Yes, Allah will accept your repentance. He will forgive your past sins as long as you quit sinning forever." Then Bishr repented and he became one of the most famous, pious and saintly personalities of his time. And in order to show his gratitude for this blessing, he used to walk bare feet till the end of his life. That is why he was called Bishr al-Hafi, meaning Bishr the barefoot. So look, brothers and sisters, just one sentence changed his life. He changed from a sinner to a saint. Just one sentence jolted him out of his slumber. It threw him out of his negligence, out of his ghafla. Brothers and sisters, let me share this beautiful passage with you. Ayatullah Jawadi Amli writes in his book, Stages of Morality in Quran, that man is imperfect. He is naqis. He is always traveling towards perfection, towards kamal. If he falls asleep on his way, then he will be looted by the highwaymen and the dacoits and the devils. And if he does not know that he is a traveler in this world, then he will be stagnant where he is. If he has no movement in his life, no motion, there will be no improvement too. There will be no growth in him. He will rust and perish. If one has no action, no movement in his life, he is either sleeping or intoxicated. His wisdom is intoxicated. Now, this intoxication could have several reasons. For example, one could be intoxicated by wealth, or one could be intoxicated by power, or by status, or by pride, or by youth. This intoxication is dangerous. It could overlap the wisdom and throw us into a deep slumber where man stops thinking. In this universe, everything is moving towards the eternal. This world is a place of action and movement. Even death does not stop us from moving. Even in barzakh, we will be struggling to move forward. There is no rest, neither in this world nor in the barzakh. The only place of rest is paradise, the darul qarar, the place that souls will find comfort, the place that souls will find eternal peace, the place that souls will find happiness. So to have a better life, I need to be a better person by waking up from my slumber, from my ghafla, and get on my feet to reach that eternal peace. And alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So I need, so I need, all I need.
Your love is all I need.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
European officials and human rights groups warned the UK's right-wing government is on the brink of violating the Geneva Conventions if it follows through with a plan to open up an offshore hub where refugees will be sent if they attempt to enter the country. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading UK Weighs Shockingly Cruel Plan to Detain Refugees in Offshore Holding Centers. Stay tuned for more. European officials and human rights groups warned the UK's right-wing government is on the brink of violating the Geneva Conventions if it follows through with a plan to open an offshore hub where refugees will be sent if they attempt to enter the country. Home Secretary Priti Patel plans to introduce the Nationality and Borders Bill, seeking to enable the government to send asylum seekers to an offshore location in Africa for processing. The Home Office is reportedly in talks with Danish officials regarding possibly sharing a processing center following the passage of a similar law in Denmark this month. Ylva Johansson, the European Commissioner for Home Affairs, said in a statement after Denmark passed its law that the system aiming for external processes outside the EU, instead of protecting the right to apply for asylum in the EU, would send a strong and wrong signal to the outer world. The planned British legislation is designed as a deterrent for refugees who try to travel to the UK, according to inews.co.uk, and will involve deporting people who enter Britain without the right paperwork to the European countries through which they traveled. Amnesty International UK called Patel's planned legislation an unworkable attempt to avoid the country's duty to refugees under international law and a shockingly cruel approach to people seeking asylum. The UK receives very few people seeking asylum, and yet the government continues this utterly reckless discussion about finding another country to carry out its responsibilities, said Tom Davis, the organization's refugees campaign manager, adding, if true, this move would be extremely damaging and will give a green light to other countries to also shirk their responsibility. The non-profit advocacy group Refugee Council called the offshore processing scheme an act of cruel and brutal hostility towards vulnerable people. Through no fault of their own, they have had to flee war, oppression, and terror, said the group, which supports thousands of refugees in the UK each year with legal advice, mental health counseling, and integration into their new communities. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government has decried the country's so-called refugee crisis despite receiving far fewer asylum applications than other European countries like France and Germany and being home to only about 1% of the world's refugees. Johnson is reportedly supportive of Patel's plan after about 5,600 asylum seekers crossed the English Channel so far this year. In February, journalist Andrew Canali wrote at Foreign Policy that Patel and Johnson have sought to create a refugee crisis in the absence of an actual problem for the benefit of the right-wing press and government. Faced with a modest trickle of rickety boats washing up on British shores in the months before Brexit and since, Britain's government has begun to stoke an ugly culture war by linking asylum with danger and chaos, Canali wrote. For a country that seeks to rebrand itself post-Brexit as an outward-looking champion of the rules-based international order, and a prime minister who seeks to distance himself from the recently unseated U.S. president and his xenophobia, it is a parochial and authoritarian run. Amnesty International UK recently demanded British officials stop Patel's plan from coming to fruition and ensure the country meets its obligations to receive refugees. Davies said ministers must put an end to this and instead commit to ensuring that people who seek asylum in this country are properly supported and their claims dealt with fully, fairly, and efficiently.
Africa Today.
French President Emmanuel Macron says he recognizes that his country bears a heavy responsibility for the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, in which nearly a million people had lost their lives in a period of only 100 days. Now, during a recent visit to Kigali, Macron failed to meet the expectations of many who wanted him to apologize for the genocide. An activist working with Rwanda genocide survivors insists that France must apologize. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today. I'm your presenter, Mubarak Heniam. Now, this week's edition is focusing on crimes by two major European powers in Africa. In the first segment of our program, we are analyzing the recent visit to Rwanda by President Macron of France, where he publicly acknowledged his country's terrible responsibility in Rwanda's genocide, but refused to apologize. In the second part of our program, we shall discuss the genocide perpetrated by Germany in Namibia over 100 years ago. Now, to compensate for its atrocities, the German government recently offered an apology and pledged 1.1 billion euros only in financial aid over a 30-year period. The descendants of the genocide victims have rejected the aid offer and are demanding full reparations.
We are living in poverty because of what they did to us at that time. Now we want them to restore our dignity. Reparations must come, and we want our land back.
Join us till the end of our show as our analysts delve deep into these two subjects.
Macron refuses to apologize over Rwanda genocide.
Survivors of the 1994 Rwandan genocide say they're disappointed after French President Emmanuel Macron gave no clear apology over his country's role in the massacre of almost a million people in the African country. Speaking during a visit to Kigali last May, Macron claimed that France was not an accomplice in the Rwanda genocide and thus refused to offer an apology. The French president gave his speech at the Kigali Genocide Memorial Center at Gisozi, where some 250,000 victims of the 1994 genocide are buried.
Macron's visit follows the release in March of a report by a French inquiry panel that said a colonial attitude had blinded French officials and the government bore a serious and overwhelming responsibility for not foreseeing the genocide. However, the report absolved France of direct complicity in the killings. In April, Rwanda also released a report on France's role in the genocide against the Tutsi. For an incisive analysis on this subject, we have contacted Claude Gatebuke, a Rwandan war and genocide survivor, and the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We also have with us here today Philip Rengens, an author and academic. He has acted as an expert witness on the law and politics of Rwanda, Burundi, and the DRC in national courts in several countries, and before the International Tribunal for Rwanda. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, let's start with you, Gatebuke. Why has Macron accepted French responsibility in Rwanda genocide, but refused to offer an official apology?
Since the genocide, there has been accusations, including court cases in France, where the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, has been accused of shooting down the plane of his predecessor, President Juvenal Habyarimana. And the shooting of the plane sparked the genocide. So the French have gone back and forth with the Rwandan government with a love-hate relationship. My sense is that Emmanuel Macron does not actually believe in what he's saying, because if he actually did, he would offer an official apology. But I'm sure he wants to leave this hanging over the government of Rwanda, that when they would like to bring up this accusation again of the Rwandan president shooting down the plane in the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which is the party in power, being responsible for the crime that started the genocide, that sparked the genocide, that they could still reopen the case.
Thanks for that. Now, it's quite an interesting viewpoint. Edige Nkuranga, the president of Ibuka, an umbrella organization that connects group aiding survivors of the genocide, has condemned Macron, saying he did not present a clear apology for France's role in the 1994 genocide. Let's now bring in Professor Rengens. Why did Macron refrain from apologizing over France's involvement in the Rwanda genocide?
Well, it may well be that he felt, and he will probably have been advised on that, he might feel that if you offer apologies, a claim for reparations might follow. Remember, the German government apologized for the genocide of the Herero in current-day Namibia, and Germany is now paying pretty hefty reparations, so I suppose Macron didn't want to expose France to a demand for reparations.
Countless thousands of children were slaughtered during the Rwandan genocide that was enabled by France. Proof of the carnage is still visible throughout the country. Across the country, individual killers carried out their work with unfathomable cruelty. A survivor explains here how children were killed.
Yeah, it was full of children, died. They took the children, they drop on the wall, they put on the wall, like this. You see, these are the blood of children.
If France was to offer an apology to Rwandans over the genocide, what would be the implications?
An official apology, I think, would the implications would be that whoever is a responsible party in the genocide